Blog Talk Radio.
We are the UR Tennis Network. Our mission is to be the voice of tennis. We enlist a team of passionate enthusiasts to promote our sport. We strive to bring interesting perspectives on the many spins of tennis. Our goal is to provide the learners of our sport with current news and information from many angles. We seek active participation from communities interested in tennis, but tennis is not interested in them. We are expanding our outreach. Tennis is a true lifetime sport that needs to be talked about, and the UR Tennis Network pledges to pursue this idea relentlessly.
Hello, hello, and welcome to Infinite Tennis with Bill Patton, your friend in the radio business. You can reach me on Twitter at School of Tennis. Tweet me a question for a future show with the hashtag Infinite Tennis, and you may have your question read on the show. We made it through to week two, and we have all the snarkiness that you love, along with a great guest in Matt Cronin, possibly the most socially connected tennis journalist in the world, with his 21,000 Twitter followers, a staggering number. We'll get to know Matt a little bit, and then Matt would probably rather talk about Rafa and Federer, Murray, and the Joker of the ATP, the big three of Serena and Shaparova, Vika, the Shrikas, right? Is the shrieking less these days? I'm not really watching that much. Okay, he will compare them to what he says is the greatest season in tennis history, all right? Might have to read about that one. All right, so now we're back with Play Better Today, and we're going to have a little more Rubber Meets the Road. Next week we might start a new segment called Storytime with Uncle Bill, but only if everybody behaves and eats their veggies. So, you know, report back on that. Infinite Tennis does not obey the rules for rules' sake. Infinite Tennis scares itself with its own immensity and responds by building on a solid foundation for something solid to land upon. All right, so here we go. Play Better Today. Last week we talked about vision of the ball, and this week we're going to talk about precision footwork. Remember that all these things that I'm sharing are great to think about, but you still need a coach, and you need to shop well for an experienced professional who has a thorough knowledge of the game who can help you build these concepts into your game. I know as a coach, I get people, and they bring me their ideas of what they think they're trying to do, and there's almost always something that needs to be corrected and fine-tuned in the understanding. So, you know, all this stuff is for entertainment purposes, but you can use it and take it to a pro. It's gonna do you well. All right, so I love the phrase precision footwork because it describes exactly what you need. All right, why precision? Because it's the precise footwork that gets you to the contact point so that you can be still, on balance, with great posture, meeting the ball in the center of your strength. Notice how all the great players have a still moment just prior to the forward phase of their swing. How is this achieved? Many different ways. Should you practice footwork in every possible direction and style? Absolutely. Should you think about your feet while you're playing? No. Does everyone move the same way? Absolutely not. So, you know, go at it with a menu of understanding, and you want to have all the options to be able to move any which way. But goal is to have that place where you're hitting the ball very nicely. Here's your homework assignment. Look at super slow motion clips of top players and see how many the rules of convention they break on the way to the ball. Then look at the commonalities of how they move. If they're under those conditions of having to face such a difficult ball and can arrive at the ball in such fine finish, then yes, you can do that too much of the time. Maybe not with the same grace, but it's the end that matters. So arrive at the ball on balance with one or both feet. Have a still moment. Then your forward swing can go to a contact that's very clean. So enjoy your precision footwork. All right, so we're going to go on to a short break here, and then when we come back, we're going to go to where the rubber meets the road.
Alternative Lighting and Power is a renewable energy solutions-focused company with an emphasis in helping athletic facilities. We would like to upgrade your tennis complex to the 21st century. We offer a range of services that will upgrade your tennis complex. We can use our technology to make your facility virtually disappear from the energy grid. We can provide lights, scoreboards, scoring systems, cooling systems, heating systems, camera systems, covered seating areas, wastewater management, and even new buildings. Our company is located in Houston, Texas, but we provide services to all 50 states and internationally. We would love to visit with you about our opportunities. Please contact Ed Love at 832-549-4193 or email at elove@alternativel-p.com. You can also visit our website at www.alternativel-p.com. We are the sunny side of business.
Okay, great. Thanks for that. And, you know, I just got my little sip of Java right there. Hope you did too. Okay, so it's where the rubber meets the road. When we get done with this, then we're going to start in with Matt and get going really well. All right, so where the rubber meets the road. Well, you know, on the road to your match is the time that you need to prepare, right? General Patton said, failure to prepare is preparing to fail, right? And there are a few mistakes that are pretty common among players that fill them with regret after a match because they felt like they woulda, coulda, shoulda played better, right? So one of the most common ones is that people start too late to prepare mentally for the match. Sometimes the preparation starts before the day arrives. You know, you want to prepare all your goodies, get all your equipment ready to go the night before so that you're not hustling around in the morning, right? You want to visualize how you want to play on the day. Maybe you get a scouting report, you figure out something about your opponent, and you can make an adjustment to your game plan. On the day of the match, don't wait for your warm-up period to start, rehearse a little bit before you even warm up how you want to play that day, right? This is, you know, watch skiers. Skiers go through this whole thing of visualizing before even the day of the race, and then you'll see them in the gate going through that same thing that they've already previously rehearsed. Same thing here. Then during your warm-up, now you're queued up with how exactly you're going to play that day, right? Consider this too. 8 a.m. matches, you know, it takes 2 hours to wake up, so you better be sure that you're awake at 6 a.m. for that. Another mistake people make is they expend too much nervous energy prior to a match. Instead of expending that energy, retain it. It's okay to be nervous because you can actually change it and use the word excited instead and let that excitement build. Probably going to help you have a better start. A lot of times the people that are blowing off all their nervous energy in a match, before a match, those are the ones that are going to have a hard time getting off to a fast start. So, you know, I didn't get through all this with the rubber meets the road here, but it's time to bring Matt out here in a moment. And when he's done, then I'm going to get back to this feature, but I don't want to keep him holding too long, all right? So let's see here. Hello, Matt, are you there?
I'm here. Can you hear me, Bill?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
I can. Nice to be there.
Excellent. So how's everything?
It's fantastic. I'm visiting some friends from Oakland, where we met, down here in Carmel, and there's no fog, and it's sunny and beautiful. So kids are sleeping. I'm up early, very happy.
Awesome. That's great. So, yeah, that's terrific. So tell us a little bit about what you do.
Okay. Well, what I do is I've been a journalist. This is my 21st year covering tennis, mostly right. But I do radio broadcasts at all the Grand Slams, Australia, Roland Garros coming up, Wimbledon, the U.S. Open, and then some other broadcasting stuff in between. I do a lot of news reporting for tennis.com and Daily Tennis News. I do some work for Tennis Channel. I have a website. I have a lot of work for Reuters. Just helped start a new tennis magazine called Tennis Journal. So I'm sort of all over the place every day. I get up early, watch my tennis, you know, write about it a little bit, do the reporting. So it's busy, but I still like it, you know, over two decades in. I get excited still about big matches, which is a good thing. Some of my colleagues tend to get bored after a while, and I can't say that every single day I'm jumping up and down to rank with tennis, but most days I am, and that's a good thing in anyone's career.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. I mean, I can honestly say there's some days I don't want to go teach tennis. So, but those are pretty rare. All right, well, how did you get started in all this mess?
Well, I mean, to make a fairly long story short, I was a journalist before I was a tennis journalist. I started my first job went to school in San Diego. My first job at school was actually in Mexico City. I worked there for a couple of years doing finance and politics. Did actually cover Davis Cup time, my first official thing as a tennis journalist. I covered Australia versus Mexico, actually a very exciting match where Pat Cash was still involved. I think that was back in 88. And then continued on writing about politics. Then 1992, I got married. My wife moved up to the Bay Area. I owed her a move. Did a little business reporting up here. And then she was pregnant with our first kid. And I thought, okay, I'm just working way too many hours. And I saw an advertisement for a job in tennis. I played as a junior, always followed it. And that was within my tennis magazine. Got the job, and I guess you could say the rest is history. And then, of course, it turns out I worked just as many hours in sports as I did in politics and business, right?
That's great. That's great. You know, it's funny. I you know, as of last week, I'm also a member now of the media, I suppose. But, you know, there are people who are much more serious about journalism, and, you know, if they've thought about getting into this arena, what advice would you give them as they're trying to get started and gain a foothold?
I think, I'm asked this at least a few times a year ago, you know, people email me and say this, mostly younger people, and I'll say the first thing you need to do is learn how to write. You need how to be a reporter. You need to show people. It's very hard to just pick a story or anything, you know, whether you want to cover a city council or whether you want to cover something in economy, and just go up and say to an editor, this is the thing I want to cover. Really, you need to learn how to write, how to analyze, sort of become an expert if you can in that particular field, and then maybe you can move into tennis. I have seen a few people kind of come in through the side door and be somewhat successful because the new journalism economy does allow within some people to make a standard living off it, but it's much more difficult that way. So I would say that pretty clearly. If you look at tennis and you're not having that much of a problem writing about it once you get there, but you've got to get there first.
Yeah, that's great. You know, I think the connection that we have is not the greatest, so it might be what we're going to do in a moment. We're going to go to a commercial, and if you can, do you have that landline available to you?
Let me check on that. One way or another, I'll call back on something.
I mean, I hope our listeners are hearing you well. I'm catching most of it enough to understand. But if you could check on that, I'm going to go to a commercial here in about 10 seconds. So that's going to last about 45 seconds. All right?
Okay. All right. Bye-bye.
All right. Thank you, Clutchy.
This is Jason Haynes, CEO of the UR Tennis Network. We are proud to announce the 2013 summer camp season has begun. At ussportcamps.com, you can plan out a Nike tennis camp experience. These are offered to both adults and juniors for day and overnight camps. Visit ussportcamps.com to pick up a brochure and join over 50,000 youth who say yes to our summer camp experience. Join a Nike tennis camp at www.ussportcamps.com or call us at 1-800-NIKE-CAMPS. In 2013, let our summer camps be your victory. Choose the Nike tennis camps and take your game to the next level.
Okay, so we're back here, and Matt is checking into all of that. So I'm going to go ahead with a little more on the where the rubber meets the road until we get Matt back here. I just want to make sure that everyone can hear him very well. There he is right there. So let's see if we got him now. All right. So are you there?
I am, Bill. Can you hear me better?
Oh, that is so much better. Thank you so much, and I'd like to thank your hosts for me and my listeners here that we got that going. All right, so thank you very much. And now, how would you say that the industry has changed over time from when you began or even prior to your beginning?
Well, it's changed dramatically because when I started, there was basically, I'm trying to think if there even was internet. I know when I started as a journalist, there was zero internet whatsoever. Basically zero internet whatsoever. So that really has changed the landscape because you're going from print reporting where you could write a story, say if you're working for a daily newspaper and file it at 9 or 10 o'clock, and if you had an exclusive, it would last till the next day, till people got the newspaper on their front step. But now, because the age of the internet, and we see this on Twitter, and I'm on Twitter constantly, it's a 24-hour-a-day, 7-day-a-week, 365-a-day-a-year cycle. I mean, that's a one big change. So if you have any type of information, you have to put it out there or someone else is going to beat you. Plus, it's allowed the newspaper industry itself and the magazine print industry has declined, and the internet economy has somewhat picked up. So you have some of the traditional reporters got pushed out, and then we have some newer folks come in. But what I've also seen is it's a shrinking press corps, especially in the United States. I mean, I am one of the very few people, I would say there's maybe 50 people in the world, maybe not even like 45, who actually make a full-time living off of tennis writing about it. And in the United States, we're just talking about a couple. So that's changed a lot because it also changes the dynamic that you have with officials in the industry, players in the industry. In some ways, it's very good because the players only see a few of us year-round and you get to know them. In other ways, it's bad because it does not help for the exposure of the sport at all.
Interesting. So, hey, what's your Twitter handle so that
Tennis Reporters is my Twitter handle.
Okay, excellent. So you might get like two or three more people right there. So,
there we go, hundreds.
All right. So now, you know, we want to get into where should we start? Should we start with the current age of players, with the top four and the top three, and the, you know, including the Shriekers, or do you want to go 70s, 80s, 90s to the present? Where do you want to start?
Well, we can, you know, we can start wherever you want. What with the evolution of the game, we can start open era, you know, 68. To where it is today. I mean, I think in general, Bill, and you see this because you teach, and most people are listening to you see this, of course people get taller, bigger, stronger, faster every single year, right? And of course the technology improves to a certain degree. So I think for me, comparisons in between eras is very tough because to me, you actually have to make an assumption that, say, a Stan Smith or an Ash or a Connors, they would be taller, bigger, stronger, playing with new technology today if they're playing against Federer, Nadal, Djokovic, and Murray. So all that, I mean, in some ways it makes it fun, but I don't think the game is extraordinarily better than it used to be. But, I mean, you watch those old tapes, and we all know the ball's been hitting, being struck a lot harder, and people are moving to it. I mean, I wrote a book that came out a couple years ago called Epic, John McEnroe, Bjorn Borg, and the Greatest Season Ever, which is a lot about 1980, but it goes back and does all the 70s. So I watch a tremendous amount of tape. And I still love watching some of those classic matches, but they are not, it's not like watching Djokovic and Nadal hitting the crap out of the ball for 5.5 hours in a row at light speed. It's just not.
Right. Let me throw something at you, because it used to be that you could either be fast or you could be powerful or you could be one of these little spin chess master types, and you'd have a top 20 career. You know, if you could combine two of those, then you might be top five or number one, right?
Mm-hmm.
But then it seemed like you had to be either the fastest guy or the most powerful guy, and then now where are we? I mean,
wow.
You have to be fast and powerful and a chess master. No? Okay, we lost Matt there for a second. Don't know what happened there. I guess that question was too powerful. Maybe not. I hope not. So hopefully we'll get Matt back here quickly. And I'm going to fill this time again with going back to the things that people do as they're preparing for their matches. We talked about extending the nervous energy. So, Matt, I hope you're out there. I wonder if I don't know that I have his callback number right here. So as you're leading up to a match, you know, a lot of times the way people waste their nervous energy is that they engage in idle conversation, and they may even talk too much about their match, and they start getting too much into their head on how things are going to go in that match. I much more prefer to see people become very quiet and even kind of get into a mode where they're kind of like a wind-up toy getting ready to explode. And, you know, keep it in, store it in. Then when you go out on that match, you're going to play really well. Another thing in preparation is that many times people will warm up for less than 20 minutes. You really do need to get that warm-up period that is going to really get you your full complement of shots completely warmed up. So I'm typing in, here we go. So we got Matt back now. I don't know what happened there. So I'm going to finish this point, and then we'll get Matt back on the show here. So use your full 20 minutes, and make sure you hit 10 minutes of worth of ground strokes and spin the ball differently and all that. Make sure you get 5 minutes of volleying, and minimum 5 minutes of serving, and then you're going to be much more prepared. All right, so we're going back to Matt here. How are you doing? You back?
I am back. I don't know what happened there, and I must have been talking to myself for at least a minute there. So where?
Oh, no, too bad. So I thought it was because my question was too powerful.
It threw me for a loop, huh?
Okay. Well, so I hope that you. I'm sure that now that you formed that thought, it's going to be really good for us. So anyway, so let's just recap the question. It was the transition of the more bigger, faster, stronger, more aspects of the game. Okay, so
right. So we were going. I don't know how much you heard me talk about Federer, Nadal, Murray, and Djokovic, and where that. Can you still hear me?
Yeah, I can still hear you. Are you hearing me?
Yeah, I can hear. So essentially, you get four guys who move beautifully. They anticipate well. They return serve to the point where they can actually put, and if you watch pro tennis, men's pro tennis today, you do not find that many guys like those four who get back first serves and put them into neutral position on a consistent basis and then can do something in the rally. The mental toughness factor is there for sure. They all have certain weapons, different weapons, but you know they can either rip the forehand, rip the backhand, you know, go off the court, hit these amazing passing shots down the line. All a pretty good first serves. Murray's second serve is negligible, but they're all great all-around players. And you go back however many years, you can go back to McEnroe and Borg and Connors, and with those rackets, they were excellent, but they all-around games, you could poke more holes in their games than you can off the top four now.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. That's a great point, because reflecting back, how many times have guys in the top five had suspect mental games, you know. Vitas Gerulaitis, God rest his soul. I mean, I love that guy, but, you know, he was known for being a little shaky. And then Goran, evil Goran, bad Goran, good Goran. You know, he you didn't know what you were going to get, right?
No, you didn't. It's rare. I mean, there's sometimes I actually think, and I said this to Agassi in Australia this year, Andre Agassi, who was part of that last great U.S. generation of Agassi, Sampras, Courier, and Chang, that I actually believe that that generation had, say, better players 1 through 8 because you could, you know, you're mixing in Hewitt in his prime and then Becker at the end and then Edberg and then you had Mooster and Kafelnikov, a lot of good players like that. But he actually thinks, even though I'm not agreeing with this, but I'll say what he thinks anyways, that these that this top four actually is at a level better that we haven't seen before, and that's why they're winning so consistently. And that's why they've pretty much, you know, they won every single major since, what is it, since Federer won Wimbledon 2003, they've only dropped two of those, you know, so, and that's not very many. With that said, and we can make this current, you go back to yesterday and you look at the current world number four, David Ferrer, who's legitimately number five, and you watch that match against Nadal, and Rafa's not playing well that match, and Ferrer's playing pretty well, and he has an, you know, easy forehand put away to go up two match points in the second set. And he hits it right back to Rafa. Rafa ends up winning the point and then eventually runs away with the match. Mentally, the guy just he just is not there with the big four. He cannot beat those guys in huge circumstances. And that, to me, is the weakness of the ATP Tour right now.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, there is a huge drop right there, without a doubt. And so, but what a wonderful thing to be able to look forward to, depending on how the draws go, these great semis that in different permutations each slam. I mean, that's really exciting, you know.
It is. You know, it's people love rivalries, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's a big part of the game. And people like depth. It's interesting because fans go all over the place. People like depth, and they will get bored at times. I've seen the same two guys or the same two women facing off all the times, but they also love it when you get a classic matchup and you're not really sure who's going to win between the two, which we've seen with, I think, with Nadal and Djokovic, and then Murray with anybody on hard courts. Not so much anymore with Roger and Rafa on clay, but at least in prior years, people, yeah, they will spend, they will think, okay, Roger's playing Rafa on Sunday at 8:00 in the morning, and I'm going to base my entire day on watching that match. And that's
okay,
a darn good thing.
That's terrific. So here's what we're going to do now. There's about 2 minutes left in our live broadcast, and then we're going to go on to podcast. And I hope you're still there listening with me, but I see that we've dropped the call. Anyway, we're going to ask Matt one more question before the break. Hopefully he jumps back on here pretty quick. And then after the break, then we're going to get his picks for the French Open and possibly Wimbledon. And then he's also going to discuss with us some of the great interviews that he's had with people, who's fun to interact with, who's not so fun, which players' personalities are most pleasant to him. So looks like he's coming back. And we're going to talk a little bit about Serena and the other great women. And then we'll also talk, we're going to talk a little bit more about how the effect of polyester strings has changed the way the game is played. All right, so Matt, you're back again.
I am. You know, I actually switched back to the cell phone because I think that something's happening with the landline that's switching us off. So hopefully I'm in a good cell spot right now. I'm going to stand still because I have the 3G going. Can you hear me?
Yeah, you're doing fine now. That's good.
Okay.
So we've reached the end of the live portion of the show. And so in less than a minute, it's going to sign us off and all that good stuff. There will be a very brief moment of silence. And then when we come back, then we're going to ask you about your picks for the French, and we're going to talk a little bit about the shift in what the polyester strings have done to the way the game is played, and get your thoughts on Serena and the other top female players. And so we're going to do that right here on the other side in about 10 seconds. All right.
Okay.
So thanks for coming on the show, and thanks for all the live listeners to be out there listening. great out of it. Take care, and hopefully we'll download that podcast. All right, so now we're in podcast recording time, and Matt's still there. So tell us a little bit about your interactions with the pro players, and who are your fun interviews, and who's maybe not so fun.
Well, you know, it depends on. A lot of these relationships are built up over years, so I would say that I have some very good relationships with some of the younger players today. But the more solid relationships you develop, it's just like anything in life. If you get to know someone for a decade or so, then it changes. For example, I've known Serena Williams since she's started following Venus around tour, which was 1990 Oakland, but she was little then.
You know, yeah.
And now we're going almost 20 years now, and even though I knew her pretty well, it wasn't until, I'd say, 2 to 3 years ago where I developed a seriously comfortable relationship with her, where I feel like I could go up to her at any time outside of press if I needed to and just talk to her about something. Now that changed, you know, and basically that's just putting the time in. Sharapova, I've known, well, we'll stay with the women now. Sharapova, I've known since she was a young player. I've always had an excellent relationship with her and pretty much feel like I can, you know, go and talk to her about anything too. But, Bill, I mean, part of that is, regardless of who it is, and this is going back to what we were talking about reporting, if you want to establish good relationships with tennis players or any athlete or celebrity, you have to put in the time to get to know them. You have to watch how they play. They have to know that you know something about the game, that you're actually paying attention to the game. Because if they don't think so, then they lose a little bit of respect. Right there. And I think that to me is a failure of some of my colleagues, in that they don't really pay attention, so it's hard for them to ask the players questions if the players are aware that the questioner really doesn't know what he or she's talking about. I know almost all the American players pretty well. I know I have a good relationship with Nadal, probably a better one than I have with Federer. I have a good relationship with Djokovic, pretty good with Murray too. So again, it's timing. You know, a lot of it's time. Did not have a great relationship with Andy Roddick. I think enough people have heard him argue with me at various press conferences over the years on TV or whatever else. I get along with him to a degree, but he's.
Can we go back to Serena for a second? Because one thing I really admire about Serena and Venus is the fact that they march to their own drummer, and they live what I consider, from not really knowing a lot, to be living somewhat balanced lives compared to a lot of the tennis players. So would you say that there's some undue criticism of the Williams sisters, especially Serena?
Yes. I mean, it depends where it's coming from. I mean, they are entirely different people. And even from the beginning, Venus, I've gotten along with well for a long time. And she can also clam up on you, especially over the last 5 years. She's gone into shutdown mode. What I never really liked was the grouping of them as a pair. It was always the sisters or them or whatever else. And of course, they have some similarities, but as personalities, there's a lot of difference there, you know. Serena's a lot older, a lot more extroverted, a lot more go out into the public. And yes, depending on the criticism, I thought they were unfair. But there's no doubt, and I've said this to Serena, you know, to her face on a number of occasions, that she's deserved some of the criticism. I mean, she's had some serious meltdowns.
Sure.
You know, she's one of the greatest top five women players of all time, without question. Very entertaining. She can be great to be around when she's in a good mood, but boy, when she's in a bad mood, you want to move across go to the other side of the street. But she's very human that way, Bill. She's very human, and you see it all with her. She's not a pony.
I like humans, you know? So, all right. Thanks for those insights. That's terrific. So how would you say that you're seeing the whole clay season turning out here? You know, if you want to talk about all the tournaments leading into the French, and then how you're thinking people are playing, and how's it all going to end up?
Well, I mean, we're a day before now the, well, let's stick with the women because we were just talking about Serena. And Serena and Sharapova, we were just talking about, will play in the final in Madrid tomorrow. Maria has not beaten Serena since 2004. She came close to beating her in Miami, finally got a set off her. Sharapova has been essentially a dominant clay court player since 2012. In fact, I wrote a, did an interview with her about a month ago that's coming out in Tennis Journal that talks about her progress on clay and the years and all the meltdowns and a lot of other stuff. She, if she's going to beat Serena, it probably should be on red clay. May not be in Madrid because they're playing at altitude and Serena can still sort the lights out. And one of Maria's severe weaknesses, and we talked about this on the live, is that she does not return first serves very well at all. Great second serve returner, she has on the full stretch getting, you know, big bombs back. She actually doesn't read serves that well and have to read Serena. So I would say with the, you're talking with the women, you're talking essentially Maria, Serena, Sarah Rani, who reached the Roland Garros final last year, Anna Ivanovic, Lina. Those would be my top five. The younger players, Agnieszka Radwanska is not great on clay. Wozniacki's struggling. Azarenka's never really shown anything on clay. Maybe she'll do something this year, but she lost early in Madrid. She's coming off an injury. So those would be my top five. And if you want to switch to the guys, I mean, you could just...
Wait, hold on. One quick question before we do the guys. So let's say we get a Sharapova-Serena final at the French. Damp conditions are going to help Sharapova. If it's a slower day, it's going to help her. Okay, excellent. Now, let's go on with the men now.
Okay, well, we'll start. Nadal's won this tournament seven times. Last year, some people believe this, I don't necessarily believe it, but had it not been for the match brought over Sunday because of rain, remember that Novak went on that run, that maybe Djokovic actually wins the title, but he doesn't, so you can all score that victory. Coming Monday. Now, if it takes his first loss ever in the final Monte Carlo, Djokovic, beginning of April, he's probably good. Rafa's probably going to win Madrid. Djokovic is knocked out. Federer's out. Murray's out. It's hard losing Federer. So you absolutely have to consider the guy.
You're breaking up on me here.
Yeah.
You're kind of breaking up on me a little bit. So, all right. Let's see what happens here. So, okay, keep going, and I'll let you know if I hear you fine. How about that?
Okay. So let me, I don't know where I was with that, but I'll just go back and say that anyone who wins a Roland Garros seven times out of 9 years, is going to be the favorite going to that tournament because three out of five sets matter great. That's what people sometimes forget. In the lead-ups is that they're playing two out of three. And all the top guys have said this is three out of five sets, you have a chance to win it for the lesser player. The more the match goes on, the more you give the greater player an opportunity to figure things out, which is why you see big four instantly dominant.
Yeah.
Put Rafa in there. I mean, Djokovic is the clear number two. I don't see anybody outside of Djokovic having even a minor shot against Rafa at the French. I just don't. So, you know, Federer is going down a level. He hasn't had a good year at all. He lost an initial on clay, which is almost unthinkable a couple of years ago. And Murray hasn't shown much on clay either. Ferrer can't be. None of the other Spaniards can beat Rafa. So who is it going to be? Like a young guy like Dimitrov on three out of five sets? I'm not seeing it.
You know, Matt, the thing that really blows my mind is I keep counting Rafa out. I keep saying, oh, no, he's too hurt, and it's over. The wheels are off. But how does he do this? I mean, what is this? I mean, do you think that he's playing through tremendous pain and doing all this?
I thought that it depends on the match you're talking about. Okay, so he wins two out of three titles just in February, loses that awful match in the final of Viña del Mar as a bio. He wins Brazil easily over Nalbandian, crushes Ferrer in the final of Acapulco, then comes to India Wells, and the big question was, could the guy's knees survive on hard courts? And what does he do? He looks like he's in pain in certain matches, but he just kind of guts it out. And then once you get into the final stages for the most part of a tournament, he's going to find a way through. I don't think he's consistently moving as well as he was prior to the injury, but he seems to be doing it well enough. And I said this yesterday on Twitter, the guy looking for a synonym for the word resourceful, that's Rafa. I mean, he still has an incredible ability to just pull shots out of nowhere.
Yeah, and I think he also has a mental ability to block out pain. I think what he does, he gets himself so wound up that he goes into full denial mode of pain because of the desire to win so badly.
Yep, no doubt. And it's also, he's a smarter player than he used to be, too. It's not just all, you know, bang forehands until you can knock the other guy out. He has a little more variety. His serves improved. I mean, you remember when, if you go back to, 2005, 2006, try to find the number of times that Rafa, who's a left-hander, could hit a effective serve out to the deuce court that wasn't
right.
Guaranteed. Couldn't find it that much. The same thing with the T into the ad court, even though he loved to slice serve out wide against the one-handers. He can do that. His slice has improved, even though it's still not a great shot. He's a very competent net player. You know, his backhand, although it's weaker than both Murray's and Djokovic at that, too, he's hitting the down the line a little bit better. So all that helps, right? It becomes
sure.
A better and older player. If you're not quite as fast, you've got a couple more little things to your game, and that's one of the ways you can keep on top.
All right, great. So last question here is when did you see and how palpable was it the shift in the way the game is played when the polyester strings became more prevalent on tour?
I would say it was, just off the top of my head. I think the incident that comes up in my mind, and I think it was at the French, and it was 2010, maybe it was 2011. Doesn't matter. Sven Groenfeld, who's a very notable coach, he's been on the tour forever, he works with the Adidas Player Development Program now, but he coached Ivanovic to the Roland Garros title. He helped coach Athena. He's helped Murray, all that. So he's around all the time, and he's got another guy with him who hits called Mats Merkel, another coach. And I ran into him in the Players Lounge, and it was the year that Schiavone won, Francesca, and another year that Rafa won. And they were talking about the black strings, and both of them said, we're going to go out there and hit now with these strings because they could not believe the touchdown that they could be getting with players off balance, way off, and still hitting the corners. They came back, and Merkel said, I saw him, he said, you would not believe how you can hit as hard as you can with as much spin as you can, and somehow this ball's landing in the court. Now, it might have happened before that, but for me, that was sort of the come-to-Jesus moment, as they'd say, when I was like, wow. And then I started watching more closely, Bill, and you've seen it. It's sick how... So, I mean, Nadal specifically, how he can run so far to his left, look like his chin is in the dirt, take a full swing and hook it down the line to the corner for a winner. Because you do not, that never happened with Borg and McEnroe. Almost never. It was a fluke shot.
Yeah. You know, I think one of my favorite Andy Roddick quotes ever was, coming to the net against Rafa is like running forward into headlong traffic.
So true.
Yeah. So, all right. Well,
with Roddick's approach shots, it was not too easy. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, I don't want to comment on that part. But thank you so much for coming on the show. That's terrific. I'm really glad you came out to do this. And I think I would love to have you come on again. You know, maybe we can do this like a quarterly kind of a thing.
Yeah. I'll get my landline hooked up at home.
Yeah, sure. And then
I'll be on Radio Roland Garros every single day for people out there who don't listen to it. And don't, I mean, you're listening to radio now with people who's doing an excellent job. But I don't know how much tennis you listen to on the radio, Bill, but I've been doing it since its inception. A lot of people out there listening, mostly right, kind of hide from the boss with the headphones on. But outside of me, it's a fun way to listen to tennis. Plus, it's more interactive than anything else. So, you know, for people who want to, or if you don't necessarily like a specific commentator, you can turn off the TV and listen. No, or if you don't like us first, whatever. But anyway,
that's
the next gig.
I would do that because I used to turn off the sound of Raider games and listen to Bill King.
Ah,
so So you can be the Bill King of tennis, and
I think the Bill King of tennis.
Bill, be the
not quite. All right, Bill, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Terrific. Thanks, Matt, and we'll catch up to you again another time. Take care.
Okay.
All right, bye-bye. All right, so everybody, wasn't that great? Matt, I had a great time with Matt right there, so I hope that you did. And I also wanted to let you know that there are some new developments with Strings, and I'm actually talking to one company. I want them to expose what they're doing with their Strings on the show here, so we'll see what happens there. But there's some new technology that's out there that I believe is going to actually take things up another notch. I was trip testing this one particular string, and I found that with my students, I actually had to hold back on trying to hit any spin because then I was making the ball go up over their heads. So it was pretty tough on that occasion. Anyway, so that's it for today for Matt. And I'm just going to finish up this part here about match preparation. Sorry, it's been a little disjointed there. But just to recap, you know, make sure you start preparing for your match mentally in the hours before your match. Make sure that you store up your nervous energy and call it excitement. Get that 20-minute warm-up. When I'm coaching a high school team, the strongest ritual we have is there is absolutely going to be 5 full minutes of serving before we start. And I'll tell you what, my teams come out serving well right out of the box, right out of the very beginning of that match. So after you've warmed up for your match, be sure to allow some time to relax prior to the start of your match because, you know, even that warm-up creates a little bit of tension. Tension builds up over the course of a match. You want to be able to let some of that go so that you're not starting a match in a very tight situation. And in time, as you become a more experienced player, then you're going to find that state in between where you have just enough tension to go with your excitement, and then you can also learn to relax and find that middle point. We can get into more of the theory of all that at a later date. But thanks for tuning in, and thanks for your patience during our little technical snafus today. But we'll see you next week, and our guest will be Dorian Adam of TRX Cardio Tennis on the 25th. We're going to have Wayne Bryan, and you can get in touch with me on Twitter at School of Tennis. All right. Thank you.